Hello, everyone. This is AC2GS. I hope my signal is decent. I tried to go through All-Star, but it doesn't seem to be working for me for some strange reason. I don't know exactly what's going on with it, but here I am. How's the signal?
Good.
Okay, very good. Well, let me see if I could play a little trick on this radio and do what I plan to do. I'll be back in one sec. Oh well, I was going to try something cute, but when you try to do something, doesn't always work the first time, so I'll try what the heck's going on, and hopefully next week we'll be able to do something like this. Anyway, I am AC2GS, the net control operator. Technical net. Our technical net has been going strong for 43 plus years. Sunday night at 8 p.m., we all gather together in front of our radio to discuss technology and science, to teach each other, learn from each other, amuse each other, and I thank you all for coming back this Sunday night when we try and do it all over again. Let me drop for a second, and I will give you the usual link. Okay. The best way to reach me, if you can't reach me via the radio, is email. My email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. That would be either for mailbag questions. So those would be questions you could ask normally on the... since for one reason or another, you're unable to reach the repeater. So you can email me the questions, and I'll try and reply, and you can either listen to an audio stream that we make available, or we can... you can wait for the archive files that are available for download. Or if you have a topic for discussion, sometimes something comes into the news and people know about it more than other people. So let me know and I'll give you some time to discuss the topic. Or if you have a TechNet puzzle, we're always looking for TechNet puzzles, especially the ones that when you Google, you get the wrong answer. So if you have an interesting technical puzzle for me that can be presented on a radio without illustrations, please let me know. Also, if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at a NASA or space-related story, then you can either do it through me. My email, once again, is mailbag@ac2gs.com, or you can go directly. Paul can be reached at spacenetreport@gmail.com. Also, I'd like to remind people that I keep a link page up of interesting articles, YouTube, and such that I find during the week and make available. You can reach that by typing into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com. We also have a chat room. Sometimes it's busy, sometimes it's light, but you know, you can get to it very easily, roy.ac2gs.com. Let me drop for a sec. I also mentioned that we offer an audio stream on the Internet. If you type into your browser, technet.ac2gs.com, you'll have an audio stream of the Glen Oaks repeater. I originally meant it for the TechNet, but some people asked if I could keep it live 24-7, so it's available for the most part 24-7. I always like to remind people that MikeKC2NJI has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv, and it has archives of the technical net that go as far back as September 2006. So please avail yourself of that. Let me drop for a second, and I'll tell you what we got planned. We're going to have something a little bit different. I have a short presentation that might annoy some people and might interest other people. We'll see. It kind of got brought up last week, and I want to kind of expand upon it just a little bit. Let's see. Well, also, later tonight, our own Ed, WB2EAV, is going to talk about an interesting article I read in the Times and also saw web pages on. So I'm looking forward to that. And then we'll have the usual questions, hopefully amateur radio related at first, but we take all science related questions and topics. That should take us to approximately 10:15, and Paul WS2N will bring us the SpaceNet report. That should take us to approximately 11 p.m., and I'll return to tie a bow on it and wish you all well. So that's my plan. Let me give you my short little dissertation on quantum computers. I promise not going to get overly esoteric, but it will get a little mean-spirited, but for a reason. So sit back, relax, and the next voice you hear will once again be me.
Hey, this is WS2N.
Yes, Paul?
Transmissions have been very good so far. So, no problem. Just to let you know.
Oh, okay, very good. I'm glad to hear. I hope they'll continue like that. You know, sometimes it's very variable, but for whatever reason that I don't quite know, the All-Star doesn't seem to be working. Maybe I have the connections wrong. I don't know. I'll find out over the week when I test. Anyway, let me drop again, and I'll start up the presentation. Okay, we've touched upon quantum computers many times before. We did it just last week. Quantum computers, as we know them, were first proposed by the famous Nobel Prize-winning physicist and Far Rockaway native Richard Feynman, as well as Yuri Manin. In place of the two distinct high and low binary levels of standard computers, quantum computer bits are replaced with quantum particles called qubits that can exist not as one of two possible values, but as a superposition of many values at the same time. And by arranging the number of these qubits, a very complex algorithm can lead to a solution to a very complex problem in a short amount of time. The more qubits, the more variables to be made, part of the problem to be solved. The problem is that adding qubits to a quantum computer is an engineering nightmare. It requires entangling these qubits, and these entanglements can sometimes only be maintained for something like 30 microseconds. Fortunately, a quantum computer can do amazing things in that short a time. If you've ever seen a picture of a quantum computer, you might think that it looks a lot like a chandelier. Most of that structure is just a helium cooler needed to cool the actual quantum computer down to the 200th of a Kelvin above zero that it needs to operate. This temperature is needed to implement superconductivity and lessen the noise and prolong the qubit's fragile quantum entanglement. But even all these engineering problems aren't all that's needed. When you allow the entangled qubits to decohere, to lose their quantum coherence, to cause their superposition to collapse into a readable result, unless you develop a very clever algorithm for how these qubits interact and how they decohere, the resultant answer will be a random answer that is very, very unlikely to be the correct one. It is these clever algorithms that improve the possibility that the resultant answer might be correct. Without them, you have little more than a random number generator, which could be of some value in the future, of course. Let me drop. So, a fully functional quantum computer with enough qubits and some form of noise correction design gets you only a very expensive random number generator right now. There are quantum algorithms around for some very special problems with names like Simon's algorithm, Shor's algorithm, Grover's algorithm. There are a few dozen more, but not anywhere enough that anyone will be using a quantum computer to do all the things that our present computers do for us right now. Quantum computers are a source of a lot of hyperbole these days. Claims have been made by people running profit-minded research development companies trying to make their fortune selling quantum computers in the future, while others are clickbaiting YouTubers or authors in search of bestseller topics that can make them some money, flooding the world with this absurd hyperbole. If you listen to people who've been working in the field for decades, they tend to pour cold water on all these gee whiz nonsense stories. Quantum computers are little more than research devices at this point for figuring out how to get quantum computers to work. No available quantum computer has solved any useful problem so far. What it presently has been shown to be capable of accomplishing can be done with classical computers and occasionally by the average sixth grader. A major announcement was made when quantum computing successfully factored a number that was the product of two prime numbers, the foundation of encryption techniques used in today's internet and business software. Unfortunately, the number that the quantum computer factored was the number 15. The computer solved the fact that its factors were 3 and 5. Those encryption keys used in the internet are not made of products of one-digit primes. They tend to be made of the product of hundreds of digits long prime numbers. Let me drop for a sec. Google announced quantum computing supremacy back in 2019 by solving an algorithm called boson sampling. Google proclaimed that it would take a normal computer 4,000 years to solve this particular problem. Days later, IBM responded that it could be done in 2.5 days by a normal computer. A researcher in the field proclaimed, quote, it's a beautiful theoretical result, end quote, while stressing that the new algorithm is not practically useful for simulating real experiments. There are some people in the field that have doubts that any of the present quantum computers are really doing any quantum computing at all. It may end up that a functioning quantum computer may only be great for random number generation, some pathfinding, and maybe modeling quantum mechanical systems. It may be able to break the kind of encryption that the internet and our banking systems use, but there are other forms of encryption that would be much more difficult for even a quantum computer yet to be built to be able to decrypt. And new encryption algorithms that quantum computing could not deal with altogether are being worked on as we speak. Even people in the field of quantum computing and artificial intelligence caution people that combining the technology will probably not lead to self-aware genius AIs. Adding quantum computing to AIs may just allow the AIs to be better at choosing shorter paths going from one place to another. Let me drop. But then, if someone tried to sell a book with these truths, you would buy them. And so we have retired Professor Michio Kaku, famed theoretical physicist and self-titled futurist. Now, I'm always wary when someone calls themselves a futurist. I have read many of them, and I fail to remember one that got anything particularly right. The oldest one that I remember is Thomas Malthus, who predicted that we would all die from starvation centuries ago. Thankfully, he was quite wrong. I watched Professor Kaku on Joe Rogan's show, which I also wouldn't recommend. Professor Kaku's hyperbole about our future with quantum computers was rather absurd. I can't believe he believes much of it himself. My guess is that, unfortunately, this is kind of a grift going to pay for a nice summer home for him. I have included in my link page some links to a man that has actually been working in both fields for a great long time. His book review of Professor Kaku's book is available via link. Professor Kaku himself has no academic work in this field, to my knowledge. By the way, part of the title of Professor Scott Aronson's review is titled, Do Not Buy This Book, so you can guess what he thought of it. Let me drop for a second. Okay, for what it's worth, here is another somewhat concise review someone left on Amazon. Quote, background, I have a PhD in superconducting quantum computing and have been working in the field since my second year of undergrad. I'm currently a researcher at MIT and will shortly be employed as a quantum physicist at a quantum computing company. Well, I don't want to tell people not to buy this book because it seems to make people want to buy it even more. So I'll just say this. People who are in the field absolutely hate it. The first few pages peddle the two biggest misconceptions in quantum computing, that computation is done in separate universes, or that quantum computers let you compute things that a classical computer couldn't with infinite time. This book is essentially filler, separated by the occasional misconception and overpromise. The overpromises are what scare me for the future of the field. I am worried that I will be able to keep my job if the world is disappointed quantum computers can't solve world hunger in 3 years or something, and the funding dries up. It seems to me that Michio has not consulted with a single expert in the field while writing this book. After a single semester class, you'd be able to tell that this book is worse than worthless. I wonder if it is a lazy, cynical cash grab. Perhaps he thought he could bang this out without any feedback, and the blatant inaccuracies wouldn't matter. Alternatively, maybe his command over physics has waned with his age, but his confidence hasn't. I don't know, end quote. So, quantum computing is still in its infancy, and what it will make possible in the future is difficult, if not impossible, to predict right now. Someone working in the field has suggested that less than 10% of what is being suggested presently will lead to anything useful. Science is a messy process, and that certainly includes quantum computers. DX. Any comments? Okay, you doubled Wes with Ed, but I heard Ed first. So, what'd you say, Ed?
Back in the beginning, you mentioned that if the quantum computing is not doing what it's supposed to do, it ends up as a random noise generator. My question is, do you have any way of knowing if the result is quality result or random noise?
Theoretically, yes. Practically, no. If you already are doing some experiment where you have the result from an actual regular computer, you can compare. The problem with the quantum computer supremacy test, that I mentioned, the boson experiment, is that they don't even know if it's the right answer because they don't have results from anything but that one quantum computer. So, although theoretically there are designs being made for error correction systems, usually they require a lot more qubits than are used for the computations. There are some error correction that requires 100 extra qubits to make sure that the noise hasn't randomized the results for every operational qubit. So it's kind of like most things in quantum mechanics. If the best that you can get, the answer is maybe.
That's it. I'm all first. I'm all for it.
It's an exciting field, and it certainly has hopes to be able to model quantum systems, which will be a very important tool in understanding how materials chemistry works. It may offer us an opportunity to build better batteries or all kinds of things that require the deeper understanding of quantum mechanics. It's just these hyperbolous things that will have, you'll have super intelligent artificial intelligence models that the speed of normal computations will go up exponentially are all nonsense that the guys who actually do all the research recognize to be nonsense. So like most things, people can't be in the middle of the road. They either have to be knocking over pedestrians on the right-hand sidewalk or the left-hand sidewalk. So I keep finding myself trying to push the car in the middle of the road instead of the sidewalk with the room temperature superconductors, which was nonsense as well, and with fusion tests, which were nice, but not quite as historic as they were presented. Yes, Ed.
So far, all I've heard quoted are people who've been debunked by those who have actual credentials. Has anybody with actual credentials tried to put together a short paragraph on just what this is about?
Well, I mean, it depends on the field. Like I said before, if you go to my link page, there is a book review by Professor Aronson. He's a noted researcher on quantum computers. He's been working on quantum computers for over 20 years. He spent the last few years with a special focus to artificial intelligence. And he basically tells people not to buy the book. It's a very short description. It doesn't really require technical expertise, but all things considered, I would rather believe in a guy who's in a field for 20 years than a guy who maybe passed by the department once on his way to another department. You know, futurists have a bad reputation, at least where I'm involved. They kind of like to hype it up because you get more book sales if you give highly optimistic, kind of semi-ridiculous possibilities of the future. You know, I was one of those kids that always read the popular science about the flying cars that would be coming in 10, 20 years, 50 years ago. You know, futurists, I guess, are kind of drifters by nature.
Roy, you didn't actually answer my question.
Well, would you like to rephrase it? Because I thought I did. The guy who actually knows it wrote a book review. I have a link to it. So what exactly, other than that, would you be more interested in reading?
He told me that this Dr. Aronson, I believe he said the name was very, very concerned about the lack of accuracy of some other publications. But my question is, did Dr. Aronson include a couple of paragraphs on what she thinks the correct answer as of today should be?
Well, yeah, a matter of fact, I also include YouTube. He was interviewed for an hour or so, and he went into some further detail of the aspects of quantum computing that he's optimistic about, and some that he's hopeful about, and others that he discounts as complete nonsense. So although that wouldn't be quite in written form, it is available, again, the link to the YouTube. And in addition, he too wrote a book about quantum computers. Unfortunately, since it wasn't hyperbole, I don't think he sold too many of them. They're probably more designed, although I don't think he gets very technical. They're probably priced more for the academic price range, because I looked it up and it's about $50 to $60. Which is, you know, kind of expensive for a book these days, unless it's a college book. But, you know, he has a book on the subject of the entire history of quantum computing. And, like I said, there's a video interview on YouTube that I have a link to it.
I think that might be interesting for somebody to study it and follow up with this conversation.
Yeah, well, I mean, everyone is free. They can go to my link page. They can pull them all down. They can read them at their leisure. And if they want to discuss it again next week or the week after, or the week after that, so be it. We try not to keep it too technical, because you can get really down a rabbit hole with quantum computers or anything that's quantum mechanical related. But certainly, if anyone wants to check out the source materials and they don't want to respond tonight, they want to respond some other week, we never turn down a topic.
WA2VDH with a question.
Yes, John.
The whole thing about quantum computers, when they speak of these qubits as can have either 0 or 1 or any state in between, how is that necessarily leading to a unique solution? I don't know if I can phrase this question right, but it just seems that what you're going to get would be a range of solutions. Does the correct solution occur when you start looking at it, or not trying to be facetious, but I mean, it just seems that necessarily it's going to just be a range of answers. Go ahead.
Yeah, I can understand where the fuzzy math or chaos theory or a bunch of other things spring to mind. The benefit, the theoretical benefit of qubits is that since they exist in a superposition, you can pack more variables in an array of qubits than you can in an array of standard binary bi-level encoding. Also, eventually you can't figure out what the answer is unless you destroy the superposition, because superposition is an interesting aspect of quantum mechanics when nothing is observing it. Once you use any method to observe the values of the qubits, you collapse the probability field and they decohere and become ones or zeros. Now, the theoretical trick is arranging the qubits in such a way and the interactions of the qubits that when you do collapse the wave function, they produce the correct answer with a very, very small probability of being wrong. And there are theoretical methods to constrict the final condition of the collapsed qubit so that the probability of a correct answer reaches closer and closer to 100%. I hope I made that understandable.
Okay, yeah. I guess it's just I'm just thinking too much conventional, fetch and execute type standard microprocessor of computer operation. Okay, well, thanks, Roy.
Interesting.
West recognized. Yeah, John, unfortunately, you can't think of it in terms of computers work. There are no registers, per se. There are no ship registers. There are no AND or NAND nor gates. It's an interesting, weird realm. And like I said, sometimes the time that it's entangled and in superposition is countable in microseconds. But the beauty is that if you get it there, it doesn't really matter that it's only microseconds, because it only needs to be there a very short instance of time before you collapse everything. Wesley, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, you mentioned two things. One was 200 Kelvin, and the other one was helium. Oh, I heard about helium wrong.
No, it was 200ths of a Kelvin, and it uses a helium liquid cooler.
0.02.
Yes.
Okay, so that would be 73.15 of Celsius, which is not that bad. Most of the slab refrigerators, goes to minus 80 degrees of Celsius, a little bit less than 200 Kelvin. The problem is that helium is in deficit, so my question is, how big is the device? Would per year be sufficient for it?
On my link page a picture of one, and you're getting it wrong. It's not 200 degrees Kelvin. It's 0.02 Kelvin. It's 0.01 of a Kelvin.
0.01 of the Kelvin. Okay, so it's lower than space temperature?
Yes, decidedly so.
So my cooler is, my lab, in the lab is rated for 4 Kelvin, but it goes to 2 Kelvin. If I'm not mistaken, actually it's 2 Kelvin, but if I'm not mistaken, space temperature is 3 Kelvin, or maybe I'm wrong. Back to you.
Well, like I said, this requires 0.02 of a Kelvin, which requires a much more sophisticated cooling device. And if you've ever seen pictures of quantum computers, they often look like gold coated chandeliers. They're rather alien looking, and 99% of that structure is just the helium cooling mechanism. The actual qubits are contained in a relatively small volume.
Wait a minute, are you saying my chandelier might actually be a quantum computer? Why not?
Well, maybe if it's really big and coated in gold, you may have a fortune there. Although they're all experimental. There is, as I mentioned before, there is no practical value right now except in experimenting with quantum computers to use a quantum computer. But there are companies researching, developing, selling it. Google has one. Microsoft has a bunch. They have a server system where you can cloud compute with them. So it's a big business that doesn't really have an ultimate reap for existing yet, but the promise is what's going on. So who knows? If you do have a quantum computer, you could always invite me over. I'd love to play with it.
Okay. A question that I had is, if it's helium cooled and the helium liquid helium temperature is 4.15 Kelvin, and it requires many times less than that. How did he do that?
I do not know the ultimate mechanics of it. I just know the published specs and the fact that they use helium. I don't think it's practical to use anything else, so that's what they do, and they probably have some way of siphoning off the extra heat. But whatever they do, they apparently, at least for the present models, there are theoretical designs that will use, hopefully, photons that will not require this incredible supercooling. How exactly they do it, I guess you have to pick up a textbook on supercomputers, because I assume that that's one of the most important parts of building the darn thing.
Thank you for this.
You're welcome, Wes. Any other comments on this? Like I said, I don't want to pour cold water on science. I'm a real enthusiast of the field, but it pains me when kind of people kind of use it for dubious purposes. Yes, Ed.
This is what is known as pure scientific research. By definition, pure scientific research has no practical application. Historically, some pure scientific research has come up with very, very practical applications, but most of them have not. And I consider this as another one in that category, and anybody trying to extrapolate all the wonderful things we can do someday in the far distant future is just wasting their time until we know more.
Well, it depends on what you consider wasting people's time. Kaku is going to make a couple of million dollars promoting and selling his book. There's a lot of researchers out there that are being paid good salaries for many years to continue the research. There are companies that are trying to privatize research and development and make money. Microsoft is promoting a service to people. I could rent out time on one of their quantum computers. God knows what we'd do with them. People are monetizing it. People are making profits off of it. It's human nature to kind of play what-if a lot, and they do it with everything, and they certainly have been doing it very, very, very stridently with quantum computers. And I agree with you. It's at this point, it's very super. It's not really attached directly to anything incredibly useful right now. Again, it's very possible that they'll be able to do some kind of quantum modeling, which is a useful thing to do when trying to figure out some aspects of quantum mechanics. So you never know. I mentioned a long time ago, Hertz, the inventor of electromagnetic waves, at the time felt that they really had no particular value. He couldn't do much with them, he felt, and so they were a scientific curiosity. And of course, we went a far away from that point. So, yeah, I agree with you, Ed.
I'll tell you what. Just give me a couple of microseconds of it.
you can contact Microsoft. I don't really remember the rates, but they seem to be reasonable. So you might be able to get a little time on that machine.
I was to a fellow who was called. He said he rented a boat but didn't have a boat because we thought it would give him some credibility to his friends if he had a boat. So if he didn't rent the boat, you know, the price was right. I could rent a few microseconds of time on a quantum computer. You know, I have no idea what I was doing.
Well, it's a story to tell people at a cocktail party. I'm sure there are people, I'm sure Michio Kaku impresses a hell of a lot of people. So you can impress them as well.
Is he affiliated with CNY or maybe something?
I think he was a CUNY professor. CUNY physicists are interesting people. I knew a CUNY physicist, professor. He was sort of weirdly famous for taking his postdocs on trips to stripper joints. This was back in the 80s.
Don't dare fit PhD to UNY. My brother is one.
I don't think he was a very, very smart, slightly strange man, but I have nothing against them. I took graduate level courses there for giggles. I don't have any problem with them. It's just I found this guy's how he dealt with his post grad interesting. You know, I had a professor, unfortunately, who died in prison. Who despised undergraduates. He liked his graduates. I didn't understand exactly why until I found out later that his graduate students were making, synthesizing quaaludes and all kinds of interesting drugs for him, which is why he ended up dying in prison.
ZDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
Yes, you're right. Michio Kaku, he's professor of physics at CCNY. In the physics department at City College.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I thought he was affiliated. I don't exactly know if he's active these days because he is in his mid-70s, is my understanding, and also he seems to have been doing a lot of interviews out there. But I don't know one way or the other. I'm sure he's a very smart guy. I mean, the guy who reviewed the book on Amazon, who kind of considered that he was senile. I don't think he's senile. I just think he's a showman. I think he's a grifter. I think he knows how to make money. This poor guy, Professor Scott Aronson, who is actually a legitimate expert in the field, probably sold maybe 100 books. But Michio Kaku is going to sell probably thousands, tens of thousands. So, you know, God bless capitalism.
He occasionally does a program, I have heard it a couple of times on WBAI, called Explorations, where he discusses a number of different scientific principles. So, yeah, he's very well known.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard him before. He's always sort of sounded hyperbolic to me. You know, he presents things in a incredibly over-optimistic, enthusiastic manner that probably gives people the wrong idea about a lot of things, but, you know, each to their own.
Hey, Roy?
Yes, Ed?
Can I give you my brother's short post-doctoral experience?
Okay. Is there any way you can sound a little bit better? You're about 60% noise right now.
Yes, I will transfer to my magic location.
Okay, thank you very much, Ed.
Okay, WB3.
I heard something interesting the other day, and we've mentioned this topic before on the technical net. Let me just check the repeater. Did I have it?
WB2EAB is here.
Okay, very good, Ed. Please, tell me what you were going to tell me.
want to hear my brother's postdoctoral story? He's got a gig doing some postdoctoral research up in Toronto. It was kind of pointless, but he did meet a nice girl there, and today he and that girl are enjoying playing with the grandkids.
Well, you never know how decisions are going to affect you the rest of your life. You know, sometimes you choose to go left, sometimes you choose to go right. You're never quite sure what would have happened if you took the other path.
Yeah, well, that was a nice and short sweep.
Yes, it certainly was. Any other comments on this particular subject? I mean, I tend to find it fascinating. I think it's filled with hyperbole, but so is superconductors filled with hyperbole, and unfortunately so is fusion. And unfortunately, graphene kind of falls into that as well. It's a fascinating subject, possibly incredibly useful. Right now, pretty much almost useless.
Yeah, question is, how many are the competitors to quantum computing you've heard of?
Well, I'm not quite sure what you mean by competitors. There are a lot of different theoretical models, as I mentioned before. There are the standard ones are using electron spins, or else they're trapped ions. But they're working on photon based. There's probably about 10 different techniques to tease some object into a quantum relationship so that it can be entangled and it can be in superposition. So the techniques are probably about 10 or 12. The colleges all over the place are doing research. Microsoft, Google, a lot of companies with a lot of money are doing research. It's a very, very active field. There's a lot of literature being written on it. So it's it's very active by a lot of different people.
Have you heard about magnon-based computation? It's based on a computing paradigm shift and related to the spin wave.
Not particularly, unless I know it under a different name. It's not uncommon for a lot of these technologies to have numerous descriptive names used by different people at different times. If it's anything actually related to quantum computing, what it needs to have is some particle that can be held in a superposition. Without that capability, it's a different technology entirely, which is all well and good. People are trying to improve our present computers. We're kind of reaching a bit of a wall. We're running out of shrinking them. The silicon can only, the silicon transistors can only have so many atoms across. So they're working on light-based computers, but those are more special cases of our regular computers. Simply redesigns that improve their ability to do what they already do, whereas quantum computers sort of do something completely different.
Okay. There is some description I'm going to read to you. Like in electronics or photonics, magnetics is an engineering subfield that aims to be advanced information technologies when it comes to speed, device architecture, and energy consumption. So by that they were referring to, actually, to something very much known, thermoelectric effect, that is based, thermoelectric effect is known from Thomson effect and Peltier cooler effect, but it's based on the Seebeck effect, which is a special wave that is applied in many fields and also in computing. They're trying to do so. if I could send you some information about that. And to actually...
Okay, you could always send me email. They're not related to quantum computers. They don't use quantum effects. They don't use superposition. They don't model quantum architectures. These are just different technologies other than semiconductors with P and N junctions that act as gates to binary systems. So they're trying to find a technology that replaces the silicon wafer with something that can be scaled smaller and faster than silicon appears to be able to. So the things that run on that architecture that you're talking of, once it's built and operating, is very similar to the computers that everyone uses right now.
And just a few more words. I was talking about the spin related phenomena, spin waves. So there are various processes where thermal spin currents can be actively generated, manipulated, and detected, with the emphasis on the recent discoveries of the spin feedback I'm reading right now. So in other words, is that actually acts as a zero and one and could be transported over the long distances too. I mean, long distances means millimeters and to actually...
Well, I mean, if you entangle the two electrons, then you can do it at a distance. Quantum computers would use entangled spin of electrons as the quantum qubit. But what you are kind of talking about is something that's also called spintronics, which is that rather than using the on-off of a semiconductor transistor as a bit, you're using the actual spin plus or minus one-half as the one and zero, and doing operations somehow by interacting with electron spins. And that would end up, if you could pull it off, shrinking the size of the microprocessor and increasing the rate that it can work. But again, if it's entangled, it's more of a quantum computer. If it's not entangled, it's kind of a spintronic version of a legacy computer.
We're talking about exactly the same thing, spintronics. It just have a different name. So the good thing is that it's extremely inexpensive. So we have for iron equal, I guess now I'm gonna skip that part, talking about the number of spins per mass, but it talks about difference between magnons and photons, and it says that each magnon or spin wave mode has only one possible polarization. So once it has one possible polarization, now we have a quantum computer. Now we have a computer. Now we have a logic. We have a zero and one. Back to you.
Yeah, the difference between any extended architecture of the legacy computers is that you ultimately are substituting one form of ones and zeros with other forms of ones and zeros. The difference in quantum computing is that you're doing away with something that is either one or zero and something that is in a superposition with an almost infinite number of different possible values, including complex numbers. So that's the big difference. So you can use the same thing for two completely different computer systems. They have different requirements under each. So, and as I mentioned before, a lot of this technology goes by, each of them has 15 different names for the same exact thing, which hopefully towards the end, when it all settles out, hopefully will be a little bit more standardized. But like I always say, science is messy.
Okay. There is manganium and what's the material I'm trying to find? Manganese, right. If you have the first ionization energy, actually is measured in electron volts, to create the free electrons so the current could flow, so the current could flow in each, that would be the first ionization energy. So for manganese, is 717.3 electron volts, but manganium tellurium has near temperature, which is actually Curie temperature, of only 35 Celsius. 35 Celsius is a little bit more than room temperature in your house. Well, just a little right more so. That is a quite comfortable temperature for the computer to work at. And the article talks about freeing electrons, controllable freeing electrons, and by that the measured voltage is responsible for the amount of data that is stored there. Back to you.
AC2GS. Well, like I said before, there's a lot of interesting ideas in research papers. There's a lot of graduate students working endlessly to generate the research papers. And the problem is that all these things are very, very early stages. A lot of them are going to have failures for one reason or another, or not be cost-effective, or be too bulky, or be too sensitive to noise and other things. There's trillions of dollars invested in the present silicon-based technology. And, so anything that really changes it has to be significantly better in more ways than one. One of them being price. You know, if it costs $1 billion to make one of these computers and it's three times faster, only a crazy person is going to invest in that. So there's a lot of things out there. You could go from university to university, and there's a lot of people with some very clever ideas of how to replace the present silicon-based legacy computers with something else that's more scalable. Right now, it's totally in the labs, if not in people's equations that they're scribbling. So I wouldn't sell your legacy computer anytime too soon.
The only reason that I mentioned that is because it looks like we're coming back to 60s when we had those square hysteresis, sort of square hysteresis, the beds, ferromagnetic beds. And now it looks like it's a similar concept, only we've discovered a few other phenomena that were not known then, and they are now known. You said something about Google has it, or did I heard you wrong? Back to you.
Google has been experimenting with quantum computers for some time now. As I mentioned, I think it was 2019 or 2018, they announced what they called the quantum computer supremacy, which is a hyperbolic way of saying that they are able to show that a quantum computer can do something faster, cheaper than a legacy computer. In that case, it was a very esoteric algorithm that they don't really have any other source for the answer, so they're assuming that they got the right answer. And they initially said that it would take a legacy type of computer 4,000 years, and IBM, who also has quantum computers and legacy computers, demurred and said that they could solve the boson question in 2.5 days. Whether they did or not, I don't know. But Google and Microsoft and a lot of companies are heavily invested in quantum computer technology.
Thank you very much for that. By the way, I was Googling today and I found out that Bing is using heavily AI without the user consent. I mean, it's not the user consent. It's like molesting. If I move the pointer up, then automatically I see that AI and for experiment, I said no money, no honey. Immediately that Bing AI say, sorry to hear that, can I help you out? Thank you very much, and to you.
You're welcome, Wesley. Bing is owned by Microsoft. Microsoft keeps trying to put out a web browser that Microsoft Edge, which is now based on the engine of Google Chrome, so it works reasonably well. And it's really perpetually pushing its search engine since it has invested billions of dollars with OpenAI of ChatGPT fame. They have incorporated OpenAI's artificial intelligence into the Bing search engine. I don't know about you, but my Edge browser came up with a big ad proclaiming the fact that it's now incorporated with artificial intelligence and go ahead and ask it any question you like type of thing. So I don't think they're trying to hide it. I think they're trying to impress people with it. Although ChatGPT was probably more impressive about 2 months ago. I think a lot of people have just said, okay, so be it, type of thing. But Bing is Microsoft, and Microsoft is OpenAI. So it's all together. Okay, before we go for the questions, not that I forgot the questions, we'll get there very, very, very soon. I just thought I would relate an interesting little story. It goes back to some conversations about lack of privacy in our modern age. I saw this wonderful story. Of course, I'm sure a lot of you out there have Chinese webcams. They are cheap and readily available, for the, I don't know, $30 or something. You can get them. They operate Wi-Fi. They give you a good resolution. They do a couple of little tricks here and there. So I have a bunch of them, and I'm sure a lot of people listening have a bunch of them. Well, so do the Russians. Recently, Ukraine celebrated Ukraine Day, and some hackers from Ukraine hacked into the Chinese cameras that are being used in Russia and played the Ukrainian anthem through their webcam, and recorded the results. So I thought that was amusing, although it calls into question the privacy of any of your webcams. Any comments? Radio Frank.
Yeah, that's absolutely amazing. I'm very much for Ukraine and fight for freedom, because I'm American and naturally American, which means I have a double feeling of what is freedom. That's my comment. There were a few other things. The top of the line Russian armory is S-400, which is ground-to-air missile. It has four missiles for it, and it's nothing better that they have there. They took a little challenge to reprogram it to have it ground-to-ground, so it is able to hit the field of Ukrainian field to the distance of about 100 miles, not more than that. And exactly at that very much significant day for Ukraine Ukrainian not only managed to damage that on occupied by Russian Crimea, but also sent another drone to photograph it, make a short video from it,